Hey, how are you guys doing? My name is Kevin Davani, Total Connector, host of the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. I'm so excited to have Hodlon out for the first time on my show and Knut Svanholm back again with his new book, Bitcoin Independence Reimagined, after his amazing first book, Sovereignty Through Mathematics. So yeah, we're going to talk about a bunch of topics. Amongst others, I have a list of questions about, technological innovation, exponentiality by order of magnitude, central banks, cashless society, KYC, AML, surveillance, all this Orwellian shit is going on, negative interest rates, store of value, purchasing power, the absolute scarcity, the sacrosanct essence of Bitcoin, dependency, interdependency. So yeah, and the one-shot principle. So yeah, make sure you follow Hodlonaut and Knut Svanholm on Twitter. And Hodlonaut, by the way, amongst others, he's behind Citadel 21, where they bring, publishing, fantastic content. And you can find Knut Svanholm's book on Amazon. So make sure you follow me, give it a like, retweet, share, whatever you do, you're going to help me. And subscribe to my YouTube channel, podcast platform. Thank you so much, and looking forward to this talk. Fun. All right, welcome to my show, to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. I have the real honor and pleasure to welcome Knut Svanholm again and Hodlon out for the first time. Welcome, guys. How are you guys doing? Thanks so much for your time.
Doing great, thank you. Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you, Kevin. Doing good. Thanks.
Yeah,
for
my pleasure. Listen, I mean, before I forget, it's a strange dream. Maybe I need to take a break sometimes from Bitcoin. But I had this strange dream last night, and please try not to laugh. So maybe it's because I went too much, too deep into the rabbit hole the last years, whatever science, technology, the woo-woo stuff. So it was you. And, because I was reading, this few days for the third time, your book, Knut, Bitcoin Independence Reimagined, and I got mixed up with the title. Now, let me tell you why, because I posted it, I tweeted it on Twitter, and I had this dream where you and Hodlonaut came down with a spaceship. And then all of a sudden, I was in a dungeon, in a prison, like the Count of Monte Cristo, those dungeons. And I was reading out of your book to Craig Wright, and Craig Wright was like, like a little child. I felt sorry for him. He was like, this little stubborn child. It was like, I don't want to hear this. And it was like shouting, like, Hodlonaut, help me. It was like Hodlonaut would be like the last bastion, the last refuge of help. And I was like, no, you gotta imagine Bitcoin, And then all of a sudden I woke up and I'm like, oh my God, there's so many different angles, perspectives. I'm trying to think of how to start this discussion today, So anyway, so that's the story of today. So, but it's this nightmare or dream or whatever you want to call it, I had to tell me something. And it was hilarious. It was really hilarious. And I thought, I really feel sorry for Craig Wright. He's just a delusional, whatever. I mean, can I even say that he's or am I going to be sued for that? Anyway, it doesn't matter, the F word. I just feel sorry for him. And I think he will find redemption, and he will find, he will eventually come to his reasons and senses.
But he won't find Mr. Cat, and he won't find his spaceship.
Yeah, and I was going to say the space cat is out of the bag, because usually I say the cat is out of the bag, but now out of love for Hodlonaut, I'm going to say the space cat is out of the bag.
Yeah.
So Hodlonaut, Knut, I got to know you for the first time personally. That was the first and last time we saw each other in Riga, right? So I got to know you a little bit. We already talked, on our show. But Hodlonaut, I never, interacted with you. I mean, I read all kinds of stuff about you, and it's really fascinating and thrilling. But could you tell me a little bit who you are, where you come from, what's your path to Bitcoin? Who are you?
Yeah, I guess. That's a good question. I don't know if you read Knut's latest article in Citadel 21, where he wrote about his childhood stories with the Commodore 64.
Was it on Citadel? What's it called? Citadel 21 or something? Was it?
Yes,
on
the, Citadel 21. It's this Bitcoin cultural scene I'm making with Bitcoin Katya. And yeah, I think that's a good way to start to like maybe understand who I am. I was very early into computers, 8-bit computing through the Commodore 64, just like Knut. And I just got really fascinated with this new world that computers opened up for me. And I was early into these things called the bulletin board systems, like the precursor to the internet. And starting off with, like, I have had this very early interest in computers, starting with these old 8-bit computers from Commodore, the Commodore 64. But yeah, so I was I took an education in computers and basically started working as a system developer, as a developer, and did that for some years. But I kind of didn't. It was sometimes, I think, if you have a hobby and a love for something, it can destroy it a little bit if it becomes your profession. And that kind of happened for me because I had to work on coding very boring stuff or stuff I thought was boring. So I ended up changing paths and took a new education and became basically a teacher. So I worked for many years as a primary school teacher here in Norway. And yeah, I don't know. I was always, I kind of saw the insanity of central banking pretty early, I'd say. And I was always frustrated about inflation and like how it was difficult to kind of store your work in a reliable manner. So when I saw this reference to Bitcoin one random evening, I was just reading a tech magazine. I don't remember which. And I saw a reference to Bitcoin, and that same evening I had read the white paper, and I was absolutely hooked from that first evening. And I've never ever doubted like Bitcoin's potential to change the world and change lives and change the way we do things. So yeah, fell down the rabbit hole very hard, very early, and I've been there since.
Fascinating. You said you were once a primary school teacher. Now that was like a long time ago. When was that? Like a couple of decades ago, or?
No, that was not a long time ago. I worked full time as a primary school teacher 2 years ago.
And you had already like at least a basic understanding, fundamentals of about Bitcoin, right?
My
question, you know, because Knut talks about education and children brainwashing condition. Yeah. I'm like, what's your approach,
teaching? That's interesting because I see a lot of, I mean, obviously there are a lot of binary opinions out there, and one of the binary opinions I see is public schooling bad, homeschooling good. And I can totally relate to that opinion, and I think it's like on a macro level, it's probably pretty spot on, because there is indoctrination and there are political agendas going on in the school system, obviously. But it all boils down, like I know this from being on the inside, it all boils down to the teacher you have.
Yeah.
And if you have a teacher that wants to create pupils that think for themselves and that just don't reproduce information but actually critically think on information, then you suddenly, as a teacher, you have this amazing opportunity to red pill huge groups of people at a very early age. And when I say red pill, maybe I mean red pill them on the fact that not everything they read in the media is are facts, and that there exists different versions of truth and different versions of history. And I really enjoyed being able to like put some seeds in the minds of kids. And I basically think kids are amazing versions of humans. They are just so open, and I think we can learn a lot from kids, actually. They're basically in this state before they are programmed.
Yeah. And let me just say something, because you know, Knut, I mean, you break some taboos in your book, because it's about, you know, usually one is told do not talk about religion and stuff, but you know, and probably I'm gonna just talk, I mean, you and me, Knut, I mean, with Hordlanat, you probably, we all agree that it's this whole indoctrination, it takes a form that you understand the consequences and the effects of it, you know, many decades later. Because when I was like a kid, like 7 years old, I came with my father from Iran to Austria, and then I was put into a Catholic, purely like boys school, Catholic, totally conservative school, where I had to sit, you know, in the church, and, you know, you didn't get the body of Christ, you know, the wafers they give you. So, and, you know, there's this saying that, give me the child, especially the religious institute, give me the child before the age of seven, and I something like that, and I will give you back something, the adult. So it depends, like, how do you, what kind of environmental conditions does a child grow up in, you know, what's the potential you give that child, you know, in terms of you know, unleashing the power of intelligence, creativity, comprehension.
Yeah, I think as much as you can, like, if you manage to erode some of the barriers early, or like open up some pathways, making it natural for a child to explore them at an early age, I think you give that child pretty much a big head start if the goal in life is to become independent, basically.
Totally agree. And the thing the schools do is that this curiosity is already in the child from birth.
Yeah.
And the thing the institutions does is it queefs the curiosity and takes it away from the kid and tells the kid not to be curious, but this is how it is. And they tell you what to think instead of how to think. Mm. And that's the main problem, whether it's religious institutions or state-funded schools or whatever. And like, homeschooling can be just as bad. It all depends on what parent the kid has.
Absolutely.
And a lot of homeschoolers are devout religious people that want to. That's why they homeschool their kids, and that's just as bad. I mean,
It depends, it differs, because I got to know like parents from Germany, because there is the really strict enforcement of you need to send your school. And I understood, you know, one day why so many people from Germany emigrated to Paraguay or other countries where, you know, there is no obligatory, you know, schooling. But, you know, and before I, you know, we go on, I just want to clarify, it applies to every, you know, religious dogma indoctrination, because I don't even know why, for example, Iran is theocratic or Islamic at all, because it actually goes back to Zoroastrianism and Mithraism, which is more like, for me, like a more ethical, philosophical, you know, like open up your mind, you know, and be good, you know, it's really simple principles,
yeah.
like Bitcoin, you know, like.
Yeah, but those things always get hijacked by dogmatic, like you bigger entities. I mean, I have nothing against faith. I'm not religious at all myself, and I don't believe there is a creator or whatever. But I have nothing against personal beliefs in this or that. But I do think that organized religions are really, really dangerous things.
Yeah.
And they can lead to really bad things. And I view the state as a religion in most cases, at least. There are very few things that separate a nation state from another cult, or even a mafia-like organization. And it's sort of scary to admit these things publicly, because you're not, I don't think you're really allowed to have these opinions, and speaking of schools, I, as you know from before, I used to work on a tall ship, and that was actually a school, high school kids. So there was a lot of teachers on board, and I got to see how the public school worked from inside a lot. And I wasn't very happy with what I saw. I saw it become more and more politicized every year I was there, and more politically correct. And we went to places like Morocco, and the kids were assigned a task, like going ashore and interviewing the locals about what they thought about different things. And all the questions were, what do you think of gay rights and gay marriage and like all this in Morocco, where people are very religious and get very offended by this. And I thought it was so unnecessary to like to like try to push this liberal agenda on the kids and from the kids to wherever they went ashore, and like push this narrative onto whoever they interacted with. And I really didn't like that, and the school became more and more of that and less critical thinking as the years went by.
Yeah, like this the loudness of the political correctness in Swedish society seems to me to be pretty extreme. And I think it's
bizarre.
I think it's really loud here in Norway too, but Sweden is totally next level.
Yeah, and it's so sad because it fuels the divide between people, and like yeah.
And I'd say it's potentially dangerous too, if you have, because it's not like small parts of the society in Sweden disagrees with this. I would guess pretty big parts of society in Sweden disagrees with this official political correctness. And what happens if when the public discourse completely censors and like demonizes the other side of that argument? Then it must lead to, as you say, a huge divide and a huge amount of frustration and anger, I would say, in society.
Of course. And this is why the Sweden Democrats are going larger and larger every year. And I believe it's I think it's kind of sad, because I don't think it's the immigrants' fault.
No,
everything in society, I don't agree with their way of framing what the problem is. I mean, because they're also very pro-state, and like they want to go back to an old social democratic type of Sweden, which I think is the problem to begin with. But the public discourse being completely different from like the public opinion being completely different from what the media says is a big problem.
Mm-hmm. Knut, what would we do without Bitcoin, Knut?
Yeah, that's
the, yeah, what I would
something I tell myself every day. But yeah, go ahead.
Okay,
I'm just gonna ask. Yeah, sir.
Yeah, I would be a much less hopeful libertarian, I guess.
Same.
A closeted libertarian. I mean, like I've been saying before, I think this is we should stop focusing on politics, because it's all a charade anyway.
Yeah.
And like focus on you. What tools do we actually have to liberate ourselves, and start with the individual? I start with you.
Yeah. Here.
How do you? I've been thinking a lot. You know, first of all, let's talk about your book. A few shout outs in advance. It's a beautiful foreword, or what do you call it, prelude, by Hodlenaut, and the afterword or epilogue is by Prince, right? Daniel Prince of the Once Bitten podcast. And the cover is by Fractal Encrypt.
Yep.
Okay, shout out to them. Really excellent book. And I knew, you know, I know that you could have gone into every fucking possible tangent over here, and you deliberately, I think, made it short, like compact and short for, you know, the average person out there, the average noob, to just grasp and be inspired and ask themselves the question, or what's the call to action here?
I mainly made it short because I ran out of time to write it, and And having written two books on Bitcoin now, or three if you count the first prototype, I'm sort of fed up writing books on Bitcoin. I've done that now, and that you can only say the same things so many times. I mean, it's worth repeating, and it's worth like trying to get the message out. But and I think the two books together, they complement each other well, so you can view them as one book, or a two part, maybe the Old and the New Testament for Bitcoin atheism. Yeah.
It's a good complementary. The first one, sovereignty through mathematics, yes. Right?
Yeah. And I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Hodlonaut once again for writing that wonderful foreword, and for letting me write articles for his fantastic magazine.
Oh my God! Thanks so much for what you have contributed to Citadel 21. Those two articles are amazing, in my opinion. Really cool. And the two of us knows that there is one. We have one in the pipeline too, right?
Yeah, yeah. We have a hardcore one coming up.
Really enjoy those articles. Yeah. Really, it's short, compact, concise, but it, you know, it like cuts through the butter, you know, like a hot knife.
For me, it's easier to write articles than to write books, and for everyone, I guess. But mm-hmm. because when I write an article, I get into flow mode, mm-hmm. and when it's done, it's done. There's not that much to it. You have an idea and you write it down, and that's it. When you're writing a book, you have to be concise and like structured, and more writing articles is more a stream of consciousness than mm-hmm. like lightning in a bottle thing.
Yeah, there's less need for structure and less need for like the tie everything together part.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So before I prepared this thumbnail, I asked Knut, what kind of title, do they have any idea suggestion for a title? And, you know, we were like back forth, and he was like, I don't know, I took him seriously, and he said, why don't you just, you know, call it Ren and Stimpy Show? Not allowed. So I'm not even sure, am I allowed to show this? But anyway, it doesn't matter. You just Google Ren and Stimpy. Yeah, it's real hilarious.
Show it.
Show it? Okay. Let me show this. It's hilarious. So this is what it looks like. One of the images I found.
Yeah, that's me and Hodlonaut, all right.
So you know, and I thought
the Ren and Stimpy of Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's a show. It's about experience, the both of you. So, I mean, I have a bunch of questions, Knut, in connection with your book. So I wanted, you know, to have both of your like thoughts, you know, flow of thoughts, position where you stand. Do you want to like proceed like that, or do you have any like you know, something you want to like get off your chest before we start?
Not really. I think I've introduced myself on so many other pods now and where I stand on stuff. So you like, just ask the questions. That's fine with me.
Okay.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Okay. What really, you know, inspires me or makes me think all the time is this, and this is something we constantly, you know, have to think about when it comes to Bitcoin. It's the rate of speed or the exponentiality, the function of exponentiality, exponential function, the exponential process, the exponential evolution, technological development. When it comes to exponentiality, it's something we cannot really fathom or imagine, understand, even like risk assessment. You know, we can, it's like cigarette smoking, you know, like, you know, cigarette corporations, they buy, you know, they study the behavior, emotions of children, even down to 3-5 years old in the 70s even. And we can't like imagine or comprehend the risk, the danger of maybe today, tomorrow, in 1 year. And the same thing, you know, on the other hand is exponential function or technological development. And you illustrate it pretty good. You know, you say, for example, when it comes to technologies such as, you know, like Pokemon, you know, this game, when did it occur? Like in the 80s or 90s or something, Pokemon, where 50 million people downloaded it within shortest period of time. Or the mobile phone or something like that. What is, I want to hear you both of your thoughts. Like, what is it that is it, can we visualize or can we make it more understandable, the exponential function of a development of technology, of adoption rate?
One of my favorite quotes is from a guy called Albert Allen Bartlett, and he said that the greatest shortcoming of the human race is our inability to understand the exponential function. And I think this is true for most humans. We have a very hard time grasping exponentiality and what how that really works. If like the famous example is with the Hindu god that asked for a piece of rice on a chessboard, and to double the amount of rice for each square on the chessboard, which would, like, if you do that 64 times, you end up with like 2 decimeters of rice covering the entirety of India. And people have a hard time seeing what this is and what this does. And the exponentiality of Bitcoin adoption sort of works like that. There's something called Metcalfe's law, which states that the value of a communications network is equal to the number of users squared. And if you see Bitcoin in this way, how this connects to the price and the halvings and everything makes me believe that this can take off much faster than we think it can, and it can. It's not an unlikely scenario that it will go to like $10 million per Bitcoin in just a matter of months.
Yeah,
this could very well play out one day, and I don't know when, and I don't know how, and I don't know. Like the really tricky part is to know the time frame and this, like, how long stuff takes. I mean, it already has grown by so many percent, like in the first years, and the last. If you see what the price of a Bitcoin has been from 2009 up until now, it's maybe hard to imagine that it can do the same thing and more again. But then again, history tells us that people have been having a hard time realizing how powerful this thing is before every boom or bull run.
Yeah, I think the nature of an exponential function, like from a human standpoint, is that from any specific vantage point, you will go from the phenomenon being completely insignificant and not worthy of notice to absolutely overwhelming in a very abrupt manner. Yeah. So that's the gradually, then suddenly meme. Like, for example, you mentioned the chessboard metaphor with the rice. I also like the metaphor of, I think it's the giant stadium, the baseball stadium, and someone drops a drop of water in the middle of the stadium. And then every second that those amounts of drops are doubled. So we get 2 drops, the second seconds, 4 drops, the next. And I mean, this is, for a long time, you're not seeing anything out there. It's just like, you know, at some point, but suddenly there is a small puddle. And from the moment you start, I think there was something about the water started reaching where, like, the benches of the players. And from that point until everyone in the stadium is drowned, it's like super fast and seemingly immediate. So as I was saying initially, like from where you observe the phenomenon, it will seem like nothing was happening, and then everything was happening in a very short manner of time.
That stadium, like the last 2 seconds, it will be half full and then full, right?
Exactly.
So that only takes 1 second. So it's really bizarre.
Yeah.
Let me just say, you emphasize, Knut, in your book one point. I want to know both of your thoughts. You say that the more like it goes to the root, to you know, to the structural transformational stuff, it's much harder. It takes a little bit longer, at least from our human experience or historical experience, to adopt. When something like, you know, whatever that was, you know, the mobile phone or Pokemon, you know, it gets like adopted really fast. And I just listened to Peter Thiel's speeches. These really great, great speeches he's done. I mean, there are some aspects where I don't really agree, because he goes into religions again, and it's all good. You know, it's all good. And because, you know, I'm totally like unreligious, but he says that it's funny, it's weird. You know, when you look like information technology, computer technology, you know, even AI, you know, machine learning, all that stuff, computers, and it's, you see like a tremendous, you know, exponential growth and development. But he says, what about you don't see that that exponential development in any other sector, like whatever, with the, you know, the trains, you know, the transportation systems, the energy, or, you know, I could think a lot of aspects where it's either wherever, you know, suppressed in closet or just ignored. So how do you explain that?
Metcalfe's law explains that quite well. I mean, the internet is just people that are connected, and the more people that connect to it, the better it becomes exponentially, or sort of exponentially. And what was the example with a train line? I mean, if you connect one more city, you connect more people, but you don't necessarily that doesn't necessarily lead to exponential growth. It's very linear to just add another train line.
I would think, like, speaking of trains and air travel and stuff like that, it's also like the sunk cost of infrastructure. I would think, like, it's impossible. You need the huge amounts of infrastructure to run these systems, and then it's, even if the foundational technology has developed a lot, you're not, like, societies are not able to put the required amount of resources to upgrade the whole infrastructure network in tandem with the technological advancement, I guess.
No. Norway has great problems there, because it's all it's all mountains and huge trenches in the sea, right? So you have to have tunnels and bridges everywhere.
Yeah, so many. Actually, some amazing tunnels. I was vacationing in the west of Norway a couple of weeks ago, and we have some really badass tunnel projects that's been developed.
A beautiful, beautiful place in the world.
Yeah.
About infrastructure, I lost my train of thought.
I was trying to get, like, to, you know, what Peter Thiel also talks about, zero to one, one to many, where it's also in elaborated on by Safed and Amous on pages 96 to 98, where it compares the 20th century and a gold standard in connection with low time preference or lowest time preference, and the, you know, the criminal fiat system with its high time preference. And we had, like, in the 20th century or 19th century, more original innovations from zero to one, and later on in the 20s, and it's more like optimization improvements, like, you know, one to many. So this is where I'm getting at. It's like not only like trains, but like transportation. Like, what about energy conversion technologies, like without burning fuels, for example? You know, it's not like infrastructure. I'm really talking about like technology, like you know, like you have computer chips that are every 18 months. Like, you, if you read Jeff Booth's The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future, you understand that, oh my God, you know, this is exponential. This is by order of magnitude. So if you extrapolate that development into every other sector, energy conversion, transportation, would this be whatever, magnetical, whatever, trains or magnetic gravitational plasma technology, subnuclear technology, or whatever, genetics, biogenetics, you know what I'm saying? This, I'm talking about like zero to one technological innovations.
Was there a question in there, Kevin?
But you mean to ask why that's not occurring on the same level as
and tie it in with Bitcoin. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would tend to think that that regulation may have like the ever increasing amount of regulation that's occurring, but the name that comes to mind when you talk about this is Elon Musk, and how that man alone has been able to do some pretty 0-to-1 things, I would say, like Tesla and SpaceX in their respective fields have basically done stuff that was, I would not have considered possible for one man's vision to make that happen. And so it does happen, but what I'm really not sure why we're not seeing more Elon Musk's.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah.
And don't forget about he started PayPal with Peter Thiel.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So what do you guys think? Do you think Elon only has 0.25 Bitcoin?
I'm definitely he's got a stash. He's not stupid, so the guy knows exactly what his heart is, absolute scarcity.
Yeah.
He's super smart, the guy, and you know,
it's just observing it.
Yeah.
So why doesn't he wanna get more involved, you think?
Let me tell you my theory a little bit, because I mean I respect Elon Musk greatly. Like I respect Peter Thiel for their knowledge, the wisdom, their innovative, you know, spirit. But there's something when it comes, maybe it doesn't have to do with this question, with the specific question you're asking, but it's like sometimes, you know, whenever he's on an interview with Joe Rogan talking about artificial intelligence, like years ago he warned about, oh, you know, artificial intelligence could become dangerous and stuff like that. But then he's like, you know, let's not pretend or let's not be naive. I mean, Elon Musk is with one foot, whether he wants to or not, with one foot in the military-industrial complex. He gets funding from the government, from the Department of Defense, from Pentagon, whatever it is. So he can't talk about it really openly, you know? Like,
yeah, not only that, but he's being a celebrity of that order of magnitude, like, requires you to be politically correct. When he smoked a joint on Joe Rogan's show, the Tesla stock dropped by by like 15%. So he really needs to consider his actions.
His balls are really big, though. I'm continuously impressed by how he like pushes the boundary and says a lot of pretty. He likes to poke the hornet's nest too. So
yeah, he does.
Maybe one day we'll see him get behind Bitcoin in a big way.
Yeah.
Who knows?
But you're right, Knut. You're right. Elon Musk got to be careful, I think. I mean, if I were him, to be honest with you, I think it's not easy to be in his skin, because I would be careful, you know, what I would say in the public, especially, you know, when you're one foot into some technological stuff that is sort of classified, or if you signed up, you know, non-disclosure agreements or whatever, you know, national security issues. So you can't really talk about it openly. You can talk about it, but in more in a general sense. You can't go like, you know, this is my theory, but who knows? What do I know?
Yes. Speaking of what, you said something about regulation, hold on, stifling exponential growth in other sectors than the internet sectors.
Yeah.
This ties into a thing I've been thinking about when thinking about what to talk to you guys about, and that is the differences between Norway and Sweden in how we tackled the COVID crisis, and how Norway was very police statey from day one, while Sweden was not at all. And I think, like, the thing you said about regulations is there's a saying that the bureaucracy is expanding to meet the needs of the expanding bureaucracy. And I think that happens a lot in those huge oil companies, for instance, that sort of runs your country. I know from personal experience about huge energy companies and huge shipping companies, and how bureaucratic their health and safety organizations can be, and how many bureaucrats there are just inventing more and more rules and regulations for everything. And I think there was a lot of pressure from that sector and from those guys when COVID happened. I have a friend who works with a company called Flotel, I believe, who has hotels for, provides hotels for oil rigs, accommodation for all oil rigs. And they had an oil rig that was completely locked down for 2 weeks and nobody could get on or off from it. And no one could even leave their own cabin. So they were literally in isolation for 2 weeks. They could take like 5 minute walks twice a day, and they got their meals to their cabin door, like slide it in under the door. And so it has been really draconic over there from.
Yeah.
And this is completely opposite from the approach we've taken. And I'm very happy that Sweden didn't take these draconic measures, but rather trusted everyone to make their own decisions, which of course didn't work that well from a death rate perspective. But then again, as you pointed out many times, the median death rate for COVID patients is the same as the average death age.
Yeah.
In the country.
Like 82? Is it 82 or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. So, and I believe that our government sort of had to have this liberal approach to it simply because they don't have the power to lock the country down. The police are underfunded, and like they have so much else with gang criminality and organized crime and stuff to take care of. And like, how do you stop these no-go zones in Sweden? How do you stop families of 20 people living together from interacting with each other and stuff? I mean, it would be a lot harder for the government to impose such things here than in Norway. I mean, in Norway,
Everything the government decides here, they have all the resources they need to enforce it.
Yeah, because you're rich.
Even if it's like small things, it will be enforced. So that's probably a thing. But I also heard that there are very different traditions in Norway and Sweden on how governments are run and how you, in which extent you listen to experts. And I think there is, from what I read, there is a much bigger tradition in Sweden to actually listen to the fields of expertise, like in this case, the epidemiologist experts,
yes.
Which you actually listen to. You took the scientific approach and you listened to the experts in the field. Norway did not do that.
No.
We took a completely different approach, but still we have to, I mean, speaking of draconian, we haven't really seen hardcore draconian stuff in Norway at all. Like compared to Spain and
and
Italy, of course. So we have only seen like basically no one has been denied going out of their house. We've seen pretty large scale shutdowns of restaurants and gyms and stuff like that. Schools were shut down, which was pretty bad. But I think still we are among the best in the world in regards of not losing liberties. We had quite a big pushback actually against proposed draconian laws from the government. So,
but why is that hard? Like, could it be that really less corrupt, or you know, have a more libertarian mindset, or you know, are more really rational and scientific? Or?
Norwegian society it loves its freedoms very and values freedom very highly. We have a lot of stuff in place, bodies in place to protect the privacy, to protect the basic rights, basically. So the moment the government proposed this first proposal of the Corona law, which was very draconian, they could basically just make up laws on their own and suspend laws on their own. They got huge pushback and had to like back down from it.
Yeah.
But I just want to, before I forget, you said initially this thing about the average age of the dead in Sweden. And it just baffles me that people are still like, when I try to say that Sweden succeeded, because you guys seem to like, you did not set precedents to remove basic liberties. and you preserve that, which is huge. It's basically like you chose to not be Ethereum at the DAO hack. You didn't like roll back your liberties from some bullshit
pun intended.
Yeah, from some bullshit pandemic hack, but which I think was really great. But we have to. The average age of the dead in Sweden is 82, and the average expected lifespan is 82. So then if you have 2,900 dead, or how many dead you have, then you can multiply. Like, we have to think about how many expected life years did we lose here. And actually, if we do this little bit cynical math, but actually we didn't lose any expected life years in Sweden. If the average age of the dead had been 40 years old, it would have been horrible. Then we had lost 42 years per person.
Yes.
That would be like 2,900 times 40. Which would be a completely different story. So the fact that we are even discussing these numbers of dead without going behind the numbers is just so ridiculous.
Yes, and just to continue on this thought thread here, there's another aspect of this, and the economic aspect, of course, mm-hmm. which when you say listen to experts, the thing they listen to is the health experts and the virologists and everything. No one listens to economists, and they're like, you can't really stop an ecosystem for 3 months and expect it to be alive and well.
Yeah.
Like, and if you view the economy of a society, like if time really is money, then lifetime is money. And then a 30% tax on the population is like stealing 30% of that person's lifetime. Yeah. And so that is a partial death sentence. You can view it as that.
Yeah.
And if you're this hardcore in your arguments, or at least if you admit that there's a connection between ruining someone's economy and life. I mean, there's more to life than just not dying.
Yeah. this should be apparent, but it seems it's not.
Yeah, no, it's kind of sad.
Yeah,
I mean, we made a personal choice to quarantine ourselves for a couple of months. I have a close family member that is in a risk group, and we chose to like remove our kids from school, even mm-hmm. though we weren't really allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit that I did it partially because of COVID, but also because I wanted to remove my kids from the school because I could. Like when my daughter started her first year in school, there was a big gathering on the playground outside, and they said, this year we're going to focus extra on the climate, and we're going to teach the kids how to be climate smart and buy less plastic bags and use less plastic straws and all this virtue signaling bullshit politics that are all over the place now. It's like, and I didn't really want that for my kids, to be honest. So it was a no-brainer just work from home. And yeah,
the new normal is to not hug anyone, not shake anyone's hand, and to drink your Coca-Cola out of a paper straw that leaks leaks soda everywhere.
Yeah, what are paper straws?
They don't
about?
Work. They don't
no,
work.
No, no, no. Of course they don't. They're made of paper.
But they were mass produced already. Come on, guys.
The world is so disappointing sometimes.
Yeah. Thank God for
human. Yeah, exactly.
Let me ask you, because I'm curious about Norway. Okay, what else is different or like super unique about Sweden and or Norway? Now, aside, you know, from COVID approach, and is there anything like from you know, mindset or mentality, attitude, disposition?
I think I would say Norway and Sweden are probably pretty similar in many ways. Mm-hmm. I think last 10, 20 years, a difference has developed in that Norwegians have become more, some of their initiative has probably been taken away from them because we have such good welfare system. Good, I would not say it's, I would say it's like excessive and takes away takes away initiative. And I think since, because of our oil basically, and our focus on social justice, then it's basically not possible to fall out of the net, so to say. So, and I don't think that is the case in Sweden, since Sweden doesn't have the oil. So I guess, at least I see young Swedes coming to Norway with a really good attitude to want to work, and also taking jobs that maybe Norwegian young people don't want.
Yeah.
But similarities between these societies, I think there is very high levels of trust.
Dangerously high
levels of trust. Totally, like, we have, both of the countries have state broadcasting channels, which basically function as purveyors of truth, at least in Norway, and I think so in Sweden as well. Like Swedish,
very much.
SVT and in Sweden, and NRK in Norway, basically, like, if it's reported there, then it becomes true for most Norwegians, I would say.
Yes, and they're very left-wing tilted.
Very left-wing,
and
very
left-wing. Sweden. So they're running the narrative. And and like, as I write in the article there about Grow Up, we had only state-run media channels. We had nothing else. There was like two channels on TV that was state-owned, and three channels on the radio, and that's it. And then we had a couple of like newspapers, all subsidized by the government. That system is still in play. They very recently removed the fee for owning a TV and turned that into a tax instead. So the Sveriges Radio, as it's called, where the public radio and TV channels, they cost us, how much is it? Like 8 billion euros a year.
Jesus, that's so fucking ridiculous. I can't believe that.
Yes, and they tell us at the same time as they tell us we need 8 billion to make lame-ass journalism, we're in a crisis. So we're in a crisis here. We have organized crime and we have this virus and everything, but we're still able to give subsidies to cultural workers and like fund the theater and run an 8 billion euro state funded skewed narrative news channel. I mean,
yeah, we have a similar discussion going on in Austria and Germany too, about like people paying. I mean, I don't have radio or television for decades now. I'm not gonna, you know, let people, no, garbage me and with all this bullshit. So, and people, you know, are paying like 20, 30. I don't know how much it differs from one state to another in Austria. Like, you have to pay a fee, right, for all this bullshit, the garbage they're producing, you know.
Yeah, but in Sweden it's taxed now, so everyone has to pay for it. So and they buy series from other media companies. Like, they bought Game of Thrones to show it on the national television, and they buy sports events for billions and billions of kronas just to show them. And like, I don't watch soccer. I think it's boring, but I still have to pay for fucking soccer. I don't get it. And the Eurovision Song Contest, like, I'm sorry, I'm not gay. I bet you people enjoy it a lot, but if they want to see it, they could pay for it themselves. I mean, I'm sure there's a market for the Eurovision Song Contest without it being subsidized. I don't get it. Are we in a crisis or not?
We're in a deep crisis. We're in a deep social, structural, psychological, emotional. Seriously, we are in a deep crisis. But you know, I don't know why, but I'm really optimistic, like never before. The more time goes by, the more bullshit I see, all this chaos and disruptions and you know, money printing on trillions and trillions. It's, I don't know why, but why I'm so excited and still so optimistic. And I'm, by the way, I mean, I already told you, some of my guests already, I'm becoming father. We're expecting a child. So this is why Bitcoin has become more.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Man.
Yeah, we are expecting a daughter. And this is why Bitcoin has become, you know, not only, you know, for now, so many years now, I mean, at least 2 or 3 years, but it's become sort of not only my conviction, but my ethos, you know, my mission too, because what kind of world, what kind of space, what kind of civilization, society, you know, do I want our daughter to grow up with? And this is why, you know, we should talk about Bitcoin.
Yeah. what kind of path do we want to put our kids on? Like, it would be so difficult to even like recommend or explain a path for them if we didn't have some kind of sound foundation to build stuff on.
Yeah, and a coherent narrative about what it's all about.
Exactly. All this, there's so everything is just full of cognitive dissonance.
yeah, and it's so funny because us three guys, we don't know each other from before, and we're from completely different backgrounds and completely different parts of the world, and we agree on like 99% of everything we talk about.
Pretty much.
Because we have this thing now to anchor our ideas to.
Yeah. Was that your cat?
No, that was my mother.
Space mom.
Yeah. I told her I will be busy for an hour, but.
So I really don't care whether they're gonna ban cash, because I was gonna just ask a transition to this next question of mine. In Sweden, Norway, wherever, is there a tendency to, or because I know in Germany and Austria too, there is a heavy use of cash still. People are still, you know, for good reason, of course, you know. But what does it look like? Like, do you see like whatever this fucked up central bank digital currency, like banning cash and, you know, coming without some kind of special drawing bullshit, you know?
Sweden is best in class on banning cash, aren't they, Knut?
Yeah, we are. And it's really scary. We have this phone payment system called Swish, so we swish each other small sums of money.
Yeah.
And according to a journalist I know, Swish is actually safer to use than regular bank payments or credit cards, because the banks there's more privacy in Swish, since it's harder for institutions to get information about each transaction from the Swish network than from a bank-to-bank transfer.
Oh, really?
So in that way, it's better. But it has been going down. It's like all of a sudden it's on the news. Swish is down. I'm like, why is Swish down? Or Bank ID is down. We have a system called Bank ID, where you can and that goes down from time to time. And of course it's vulnerable. And like last year I had to fill in a form for my bank account, where I get my salary, and I had to state what the account was for and if there were any other incomes than my monthly salary, and like who I was intending to pay, and like all sorts of this KYC bullshit stuff that they're going to box you in. And if you by any chance get a bit richer a bit quicker than what's allowed, you will get the tax authorities on you like instantly. So it's and they do it all under, and they say we have to do this to in order to stop people from washing money or doing economical crimes, whatever the hell an economic crime is. I mean, if central banking isn't one, what the hell is?
You made a pretty good point in your book. You said something like, I'm paraphrasing, you said something like, once institutions and bureaucrats are established, you know, and like, you know, part of the integral, they will come up with all kinds of, you know, the most stupid, like, justifications, excuses to, you know, keep this shit going on. You know?
Yes, like Milton, this is from way back. Milton Friedman has said this in very explanatory ways in the Free to Choose documentary from the 70s. And of course, both Mises and Rothbard and those guys has been onto it also. Like, if an institution is in place, you can't really. It's very hard to abandon an institution once it's in place. And here in Sweden, we have like more than 500 governmental institutions. And there was one for like gender equality programs in the Gothenburg area for medium-sized companies or something that they wanted to shut down. And they just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Because there are like 20 people working there and they have their salaries and everything. Yeah. So, and it's, it is completely unnecessary, of course. And it's depressing because you can't really do anything about it. It's the same thing with salaries. Everybody expects to have a salary raise every year because of inflation, I guess.
Yeah. Bureaucracy has a tendency to grow like a tumor. It seems so inevitable. Yeah. And like when I worked as a teacher, I saw that from the years I worked, it became so much worse because like all the time bureaucrats are experts at legitimizing their own existence and not even that, but also experts at making up new positions in themselves to like fact check with their own bullshit or something. And the time I worked, suddenly we had this new bureaucratic things that we had to report to because they were kind of like, you know, it was put in place checks on that the teachers did what they were supposed to do. So we suddenly ended up spending half of our time reporting to these bureaucrats that were supposed to check that we were doing things by the book. And then you need more teachers and you need even more bureaucrats to check those teachers, and it's just a never-ending cycle of more bureaucrats.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, my wife is a teacher, and the amount of time she spends actually teaching someone something is just insignificant compared to all the rest of the bullshit she has to do.
Administrative bullshit, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's really depressing because how are kids supposed to learn anything from a school when the system is like that? It's really depressing.
It's basically back to what you said about regulation initially, like how regulation is a filter and how it makes it harder to innovate and to, it basically removes bandwidth from the person trying to do something. And I think I have to draw that parallel to what we are doing with Citadel 21, that we actually try to remove all kinds of filter or regulation on the submissions we get there, because that's opposite to what we're trying to do. We want the actual raw content and not some filtered or editorial policied version of it.
That's excellent. You should treasure that ethos. Like,
yeah.
Never abandon that thought.
Yeah, I think it's super important to get to get shit done and to get the actual signal that's inside of people translated into something manifestable. Then you can't spend huge amounts of your effort trying to obey a lot of dogma around what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. What about, in Norway, besides inflation, do you guys have negative rates? Or Knut, do you guys have negative rates already, like in some countries, in Germany?
Yeah, they had negative rates for a while. I don't know if it's negative now, because I don't have a TV. But
negative rates haven't hit the consumers here in Norway in a big way, at least. They are there higher up in the hierarchy.
Well, they have hit the consumer indirectly.
Yeah, true.
But we're not like paying negative interest rates on paper.
Basically, if you have an account, you will have zero. You won't get any interest, but you'll have to pay some fees.
Yep.
So it's like
same here.
Practically negative, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So when you explain like in your environment, people, like when it comes like to the basic essence of like the fundamental essence of Bitcoin, We often talk about, about like store of value, and you elaborate on that really super, Knut, in your book about store of value, medium exchange, to make people comprehend. Would it be easier, do you think, to talk only about like purchasing power? Like when you buy something, you can buy just more. It's maybe people have a hard time because we never learned anything, in school or, let alone, universities or anything about what is the store of value, There's
Number go
no.
up technology. That's
That's yes.
yeah. I don't know. That's the tricky part. Like to onboard someone into Bitcoin, you need to you need them to start thinking about money first, and almost no one does. So of normies. So it's a hard pill to swallow. I mean, there are people that like you introduce them to friends of mine that I introduced to Bitcoin like years ago and gave them some or sold them some or whatever. And they've been having them ever since, but they're just not interested in them. And I don't know why. People are, a lot of people are just doing their jobs, and that's really their whole identity. They do their jobs and they go to work 9 to 5 and never stop to think twice about things. And unfortunately, that's the world we live in. And the times that they do think out of their boxes, they virtue signal something. They link to something Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez said or Greta Thunberg said or like some bullshit like that. And like it's not very easy to get people to think about money. I mean,
Because that's my next question about dependency. I mean, hold on out. What's your thoughts? Like, is that because of dependency, interdependency from the system? The people are already so indoctrinated they can't just, understand like what's at stake here because they don't feel the pain points.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic. It seems to me like there are basically types, archetypes of people, or archetypes of ways of, if it's the consciousness we inhabit, or if it's character, or whatever it is. But what we said earlier, that for some reason the three of us who have never spoken together seem to get along and agree on a lot of things. And why is that? I think it's because we have some kind of desire for truth, or call it an aversion for bullshit. And we have basically, people spouting bullshit is very offensive to me. I think it's just horrible to see grown people just sitting there, not dealing with first principles and not like having any kind of accountability, basically, in what they're saying and meaning. I think it's just very sad and shocking almost to see how prevalent this is.
It's depressing.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think it's probably very what should I say, scary for people to take it upon themselves to actually form your own opinion. It's so much safer to follow the official narrative, and maybe it even boils down to, fear of being kicked out of the herd or something, like some kind of very reptile fear of not belonging.
And
Yeah.
not an entirely ungrounded fear. I mean, people
Yeah.
have been fired for not being politically correct.
It's it it's
That
not
happens all the time.
it it's not ungrounded at all. I mean, if you go out on the town in Stockholm or Oslo, and you sit down and you speak out against the stunning and brave virtue signaling of AOC or Greta Thunberg, then you will be completely wrecked and basically thrown out of the social group or ridiculed or harassed, basically. This is the how it is on the ground in at least in Norway, and I would think in Sweden as well.
Yeah, it's better on the countryside.
Yeah, I'd love to be honest with you. I'd rather be in the jungle, or I don't know, might have my own forest or something. But Knut, you talk about like on page 78 about lack of imagination, and your title is Bitcoin Independence Reimagined. does comprehension comes first, like holistic comprehension and then imagination, or is it because of the lack of imagination people can, I don't know, you know, like what's your position on the title too? How did you pick the title? Like, but imagination.
The title connects to like how we need to if we want our personal freedoms back, we need to reimagine what that entails, and like we'll never reach those individualistic goals by political means, so we need to reimagine the entire thing and focus on the tools instead. That's basically the story. There's no specific story behind that title, but it's sort of encapsulates how I view Bitcoin. I view it as a tool for personal emancipation, for lack of a better word, or individual freedoms. You use it to gain a little, and not only the currency, but the whole ethos and the ecosystem, and like the I hate the word, but the community. There's so much here that can, and so many open doors that can give you a new way of seeing your own life, and like so that's basically the story behind the title. And I talk about people's lack of imagination, and this is a huge problem. It will take a long time for a lot of people to grasp this idea, because it totally goes against most political theories about how the world works. Like there's something, everything political, everything that is, every decision made by a politician will have to be funded by taxes somehow, or by some other means. I see it as there's an origin, like a zero point, and then all politics are to the left of that. And the closer you can get to the zero, the better off you are. and this is from Mises straight off. The less regulation there is, and the less bullshit there is, the more people can interact with each other in a peaceful manner and cooperate instead of cohesive each other into certain behaviors. Because I believe people should be able to do whatever they like by their own free will, and that won't happen as long as democracy is around. But it could happen if we had the tools to opt out, and that is what I think Bitcoin is, a tool for opting out.
Beautiful, Sam. Before we wrap up with, I don't know, a couple of questions by a Twitter follower, can we talk about this one-shot principle? Or HODLNet, HODLNet, you wrote the afterword. How do you interpret, or how would you communicate the one-shot principle that Knut, elaborates on in his book, on page 80, I think it is, but the absolute mathematical scarcity discovery and black swan event.
Yeah, I can give my thoughts on it. I wrote the foreword, by the way. I'm not sure.
Okay, sorry.
But to me, it really feels like we had one shot at this. And to me, that is because, I mean, Bitcoin is decentralization. That's like also the only argument you need, in my opinion, to shoot down any shitcoin project. Because if it's not decentralized, it's a database. And we don't need more databases. And in my opinion, only Bitcoin is truly decentralized in a really meaningful manner. And to achieve that, I think Bitcoin needed to grow. I call it to grow in obscurity for years, basically to get its roots spread in the right way, to not be co-opted or made into something it didn't try to be at an early stage. And Bitcoin had those years. It had that opportunity to grow in absolute obscurity, basically, for several years. And that will not happen again with blockchain technology. And I think that's where it's at, that it's not possible to at this point create a new project that will have organic decentralization.
Oh, there's I don't remember who said this, but if you take a shower and then you use a towel to dry yourself off, you get a completely different result than if you use the towel first and shower afterwards.
That's very logical.
You know what I mean? The order in which something plays out is very, very important, yes. Especially for a system like Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And it has its history. It happened the way it happened.
Yeah.
And that's why we believe in it. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't sure until August the 1st, 3 years ago.
Same.
Yeah.
That was the layer of the Honey Badger armor that needed to be proven. And that kind of made it irreversible for me, that moment.
Exactly. Oh, I love this huddle knot.
Yeah.
So, that was the moment that it truly, truly clicked for me that this thing is unstoppable, truly unstoppable.
Yeah, and it needed all those previous incrementations of hardening of the armor before it too. It's been continuously attacked, and it's been continuously attempted destroyed or co-opted, but I mean it kept growing stronger, and just the way these attacks happened, we needed these attacks. And I think basically it's so true that this is good for Bitcoin. The meme is basically it's so true.
Yes, and there's so many people that deliberately or not misinterpret the very purpose of digital scarcity.
Yeah.
Like I saw Eric Voorhees tweet today that now that Bitcoin goes up in price, make sure to use some to help charities or whatever, to help people in need. And I tweeted back like, yes, use it. Don't trade it. Just hodl it, because mm-hmm. that is the best use case there is. And you will help everyone that owns just a fraction of a Bitcoin, because you will drive the price up. So don't switch it. Don't exchange it for anything. Just hoard it. That's the best use case, and that's the best way you can help others. You even have it in your name.
Savings technology.
Yeah, savings technology. And the thing is, this makes it such a different beast than every other type of money that preceded it.
Yeah.
Because the amount of good you can do to yourself and other Bitcoiners by simply not using it is a completely new thing.
Right.
That wasn't even true during the gold standard. not in the same sense. So I really believe that we only have one shot at this, because if something replaces this, we're screwed, because there are no guarantees then that there won't be another and another and another replacement.
Yeah, trying to FUD hodling Bitcoin is just, I mean, it's so absolutely stupid. It's like basically FUDing the desirability of owning Bitcoin. And what kind of exercise is that? Like, is it bad for Bitcoin that people want to hold it? It just doesn't make sense. And it's just basically a testament to like the intrinsic value of Bitcoin. I think the intrinsic value being that people recognize its scarcity and want to hold it.
Yeah, that's sacrosanct, the absolute scarcity. And it's part of the maturity process. I mean, it's a monetary evolution. I mean, what do you expect after 11 or 12 years? It's got to go through this process. There's no other way.
Yeah.
No.
It makes sense to me. So can I ask you, because there's a question from HODL King, Bitcoin HODL King. Where do you see Bitcoin in end of 2020 or 2021? Conservative assessment, what percentage of my portfolio do you recommend to put in Bitcoin? And then maybe you can close up, like, what is your vision? Like in 10, 20 years, where do you see society? Where do you see Bitcoin? Where do you see all of us?
Who was that question for?
For both of you.
Yeah, I can answer first. Like in general, I only make price prediction at a certain level, and we passed it. So we will obviously never see Bitcoin below 10K again. But like short term, end of 20, end of 21, I don't want to give any predictions, but because I think it's I don't think it's possible for me to do so. But like longer term, like I'm absolutely confident that we will see $1 million Bitcoin, $10 million Bitcoin
in purchasing power. Don't think in fiat, that's what I'm saying.
yeah in both terms. I do think that we are standing at the dawn of a pretty amazing bull run now. If that will play out in 2020 or 2021, I'm not sure, but I think it will be really face melting what's going to happen.
Yeah. About the price predictions, we've been predicting this a couple of times now, both you and I. And I just want to say that we've been right all along, because from a personal perspective, you decide the value of your Bitcoin. No one else does that. A number on a screen is not the value of your Bitcoin. You decide the value of your Bitcoin.
Yeah.
People don't get this. And once you start seeing that, it's impossible to not see it as like the greatest superpower that was ever invented. Like, this is a thing that I decide the value of. All I have to do is wait.
This is where a trend this goes for. This is the beauty of the term hodlers of last resort. That's a very real thing. And it's a very big difference between being a self-proclaimed hodler and being a hodler of last resort, because a hodler of last resort will not be faced at all by the fiat value. Like when this bull run gets started and we pass 100K, it's not like a hodler of last resort will start sweating and like, oh shit, should I sell my Bitcoin? No, that's not going to happen. Because they may realize like a very small amount to like balance out their low high time preference thinking in their lives, but I don't think the real hodlers will have any problem hodling through this next bull market.
No, I believe everyone has a price, and I'm sure there are some people that have an infinitely high price as well that would never ever sell. But the thing is, this is the beauty of the mechanism. In layman's terms, like everyone has a price, and you don't have to sell all of your Bitcoin. You can sell a fraction of them, and at the same time, the supply is decreasing, or it's not. It is decreasing in the long run because some Bitcoins will be lost forever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right now the supply is increasing, but at a decreasing rate, and at some point in time, it will be decreasing for every year that passes. And you pair that with like just the demand from the people that are hodlers of last resort at this moment, just the demand from the dollar cost averaging people at this moment in time. And it's well enough to drive the price up forever. So
yeah, and that's not taking into account the institutions and the nation states and central banks that may or may not join this party at some point.
Oh, that funny you should mention that, because I'd like your thoughts on that, Hodl Not. Like I've been talking about this in other podcasts. Can nation states and institutions actually own Bitcoin because of the individual nature of the private keys? Could someone actually own Bitcoin? Like when I saw that Venezuela, for instance, takes payments in Bitcoin for passports for Venezuelan expats, where does that money end up? Who owns the private key to that money? Is it Maduro himself? Is it some nerd at the institution? Is it a 20 key multisig at the institution? Is it a multisig of the entire country's population?
I would think they would just leverage like one of the existing custodial solutions, like basically like the same way the Norwegian oil fund has its assets stored with different centralized structures?
Yes, but with Bitcoin, Bitcoin is such a different beast. I mean, when the information, like before Bitcoin, information was just metaphorically valuable or indirectly valuable. Mm-hmm. But with Bitcoin, the information is the valuable asset. Like the information about the Bitcoin is the underlying asset. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't represent anything. It's the actual information that is valuable. So whoever holds those keys mm-hmm. has the Bitcoin. Yeah. And there's like, and if it goes up 10x, that person will be very much richer and can get the hell out of Boston in no time. If you know what I mean.
So as long as we have nation states, I guess they will just, you know, they will always rely on violence to enforce their ownership, I guess.
Yeah, but this is the thing. If you run this thought experiment further into the future, it would be impossible. Like in a certain article, whom I shall not name, I argue about this. When entire populations have unknown amounts of money in their heads, walking around the earth. Mm-hmm. There's just no room for nation states or institutions of any kind in a world mm-hmm. like that, or they will be so insignificant to people's lives because they won't be needed any longer. When you can store like generations of wealth in your head, why the hell would anyone listen to what any institution has to say? Like, To me, this is a whole different rabbit hole to fall into.
Yeah, it's interesting, but I mean, in my head, it still seems like, at least in a transitional period, that the existing state structures will be able to like hold Bitcoin through intermediaries or even make up their own. They're experts at making rules and regulations and bureaucratic shit. So
yeah.
I mean, they would probably manage to do so with the key management as well if they were put to the test.
I foresee a huge, huge apparatus around this. Mm-hmm. And once they start, and like you see, at least like you say, short term, and then like in X amount of years from now, it will see the first headline of a. An entire nation's Bitcoin funds just disappearing somewhere. because someone in the hierarchy doesn't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe, I mean, these organizations are so bad at organizing themselves already, so I just don't see this ever working out for them.
Yeah, because there is no rollback function in Bitcoin, so it's going to be problems for sure.
Yeah, but anyway, I see a
opportunities.
Huge, yeah, a sudden mass adoption, and through you know, hash mining of, you know, Iran has allowed it without, you know, telling people you can mine but cannot benefit from the subsidies, and you know, it's going to be like a huge jurisdictional arbitrage going on, competition. It's good. It's all good for us, for Bitcoin. So I see a bright future ahead of us. What do you think?
Yeah, I would be a bright future. Bright in comparison to what would be if Bitcoin didn't exist. Not necessarily objectively bright, but like bright in comparison Bitcoin didn't exist.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. That's really all enjoyed our talk. Thanks so much for your time, guys. I really enjoyed this. Can you tell my listeners where to find you?
Yeah, you go first, please.
Yeah, my Bitcoin stuff is mainly on Twitter. So just follow me at Knut Svanholm. And then, of course, there are my. You can find them there, or you can message me and buy them for Bitcoin if you want to. Hodlonaut is also mainly on Twitter.
Yeah. And you can find the project, the Bitcoin cultural magazine, me and Bitcoin Katya is making at citadel21.com.
Great.
There are two very good articles written by Knut.
Yeah, I've been following them. Yeah.
I'd like to shill Citadel 21 a little as well. I mean, humble about like this fanzine or magazine is completely amazing. Just the covers, the artist that made the covers. I got the painting from now, and I bought a frame for it, and just going to hang it up on one of my walls here one of these days. And it's a beautiful piece, and like that you onboarded so many cool people. It's amazing to be a part of. And I'll
thank you, man. Huge shout out to Martin Fisher, Cypherpunk Now, who made that cover and who sent that huge poster to everyone he painted in it.
Yeah, yeah. Just talking about it makes the hairs on my arms stand here. Like, it's such a cool thing to be a part of. I'm so grateful for all of this.
I'm so bullish on Bitcoiners. That's my final statement here. I think your Bitcoiners are so awesome.
Yeah, we totally agree on that. Well, thanks so much. I'm a huge fan of both of you. Thanks so much, Knut, for doing all this work. It's you're doing indispensable, precious work, educating, inspiring
people.
Empowering. Hodlon, thanks so much for everything you do in the background, and for Citadel 21, and keep up the beautiful spirit.
And for the trust chain.
Yeah, that was fun times.
Yeah.
Alrighty. So thanks so much and have a good Sunday.
Thank you, guys.
Same to you. Thank you, Kevin.
Bye bye. All right. So, what you think, guys? I really enjoyed this talk. Always fun talk with Knut, and for the first time with Hodlonaut. Make sure you follow them on Twitter. It's Hodlonaut and Knut Svalnholm. I'm going to put that in the show notes. Make sure you read or listen by the Bitcoin Audible on Guy Swan's page, or the Crypto Economy, that was his original name. It's also as an audio available. So Sovereignty Through Mathematics and Bitcoin Independence Reimagined. I have it as a hardcover, or whatever you call it, soft cover, but also have most of my books on Kindle, so it's great always to have them around with me. And yeah, it's just really empowering, inspiring. Anyway, thanks so much. Make sure you follow me on Twitter, subscribe to my YouTube channel, to my podcast platforms. And if you want to sponsor me, please get in touch with me. My email address, hello@thetotalconnector.com. And you can find me on any social media platform, LinkedIn, Facebook, Telegram, and Twitter, and yeah, anywhere. So thank you so much for your support. And I can't wait for another special session, which I'm going to surprise you with in next or maybe 2 weeks or something like that. Thank you so much, and bye. Have a good.